I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddow, and I'm very excited to be joined by two brilliant writers who are going head-to-head a bit later on in a war of the words. They also happen to have published two of the most talked-about books this year. My first guest lives in LA. In fact, she's going back there very shortly, so we must be quick. She used to work as a casting assistant in Hollywood and is now the author of six critically acclaimed books, including her first published in the UK, Daisy Jones and the Six. Taylor Jenkins Reid, hello and welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And next to her is a journalist, columnist, the most well-dressed event host I know, and author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Maggie and Me, and now his first novel, You Will Be Safe Here. Hello, Damien Barr.
Good morning, Joe.
I nearly put on a tux today because when I see you, you always, and it has happened today as well, you always look so dapper.
Thank you very much. I mean, that's because you see me in public. If you saw me at home, you'd see that I was in probably just pants and maybe pajamas on a good day and with a chicken on my lap.
So yeah, very different sort of look.
It's one or the other.
Yeah. And recently, Taylor, when I was in your neck of the woods, yeah. I decided to go for the full-on plane wear. The 11-hour flight, where I was in those sort of like really baggy, awful trousers and some old comfy t-shirt. And and I tell you what, I'm never going to look back again. Like, that is the way to travel to LA.
I'm right now wearing jeans and a shirt as if like I'm a real human. But in like an hour, I'm putting on a pair of sweatpants that I've been wearing on every flight for the past like 8 days because I've been touring. So there's stains all over it. But I'm like, I don't care. This is my time on this airplane, and I don't care what anybody thinks about it.
Do you wear those trousers to write in as well?
Are they? Oh, you don't even want to know what I write in. Oh God, it's like it's a mess. Like, I mean, that's the reason I'm a writer. I was like, what can I do in my pajamas? And that's what I can do.
And that's what you can do.
So I made it happen.
And you're at the end of what's been quite a big tour, both in the States and over here in the UK. You're sort of coming to the end of talking about this book.
Yeah.
And Damien, you're about to start the whole process of talking about your book as well. So how are you feeling, Taylor, at the end of this? Are you sort of ready to go home and maybe have a few days off?
I'm definitely ready to go home, especially because I want to see my daughter. I have been away from her for 8 days, and so I'm excited to see her. But you know what? Actually, when you start getting, like, when you go like on the road, you know, you start to get used to it. And it's really not so bad. I mean, there are periods of time, like 2 weeks ago, I like got up from my hotel and I packed my stuff and I'm getting in the car to take me where I'm supposed to go. And then I get to the airport and it says destination. And I was like, where am I going? Yeah. I have no idea. I just go where people tell me to go.
It's really infantilizing, isn't it?
It's really infantilizing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't know what time it is. I don't know, you know, and I just, whatever someone tells me to do is what I do. My autonomy is completely gone. But when you just let go a little bit, it's like, cool, you know, someone will just drag me and just tell me when to turn on, and it's not so bad.
Yeah. And as we said, Damien, you're just about to publish your book at the time of recording this, so it's sort of all ahead. Are you feeling excited, nervous, all of the above?
I tried to buy some new trousers last week. That was my way of focusing on my energies, my nervous energy, because I alternate from being sort of really excited about it and really terrified about it. And I think because of the work that I do with the salon, I work with novelists all the time who are about to launch a book, and I see how nervy and excited they are. And now I really truly have deeper empathy for it. Because, yeah, who knows what's going to happen? I think the thing that I keep reminding myself of is that all the work is done and has been done for ages. Like, the book has been finished for a while now, and that's the only thing you have any control over is the words on the page. The rest of it is publication, and I think that's a really different experience from the actual writing. But yeah, I mean, I have a tour ahead of me. I've just booked events in for a year from now, so it's gonna be a long one. There will be more than one pair of stretch pants for the plane. I expect that they'll get bigger as the tour goes on, because exercise is one of the things that falls by the wayside. So, but I am really excited about it, and I love the conversations with readers. That's the thing. Was it Samuel Johnson who said the writer starts a book, a reader finishes a book, and you know, the book that I've written is full of history and stories and controversy, and I think that, I know, actually, because it's already happened, we were delivering proofs to shops and a woman overheard me at Daunt's, and she's like, I want that book, and I disagree. And I was like, great, this is going to go well. It's not out yet, and you're already disagreeing. So, yeah.
Well, I want to talk about both of your new novels. Just first, though, you've each brought another book with you to talk about in the book off, to pitch to us, a book that you both love, you think that everyone should read. And just tease us for a bit later about the book that you've brought to pitch, Taylor.
Are we saying the name, or I'm intriguing you?
You can tell us the name. Okay. You can tell us the name.
I'm saying The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas.
Yeah. I would be happy for that book to win. Okay. I would be happy for that book to win.
Damien's reaction was fantastic.
Yeah, okay, good.
And that's going up against
The Color Purple.
Oh my God, that was my other choice.
Was it?
Oh my God, this is nuts.
I love that.
Nuts. Oh, you should win. Oh, we both should win.
I just can't believe there are people who haven't read both of those books, because they're both incredible. Oh, so.
I literally, the other day, someone asked me for International Women's Day, like some magazine was doing a thing about like greatest book written by a woman. And I was like, oh, The Color Purple. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. Great.
Oh, it's going to be an interesting one later, I think.
Yes.
It's going to be interesting. But Telly, can you take us back to 2006? Because when we spoke last time, you were telling me about how you landed what you thought was your dream job.
Yes.
Right? And this is actually what ended up making you want to write.
Yeah, that is true. I had always intended on working in Hollywood. And by always, I mean like I was 10 years old and I was like, I'm going to Hollywood. And people were like, why? And I had no answer to that, but I just really wanted to do it. So I moved to LA in 2005. I got a job in casting. I was a casting assistant for, actually it ended up being 4 years, but I met a lot of famous people, which was really cool. And one of the people that I met was Jennifer Aniston. And I had always been really obsessed with her because she's great. And and so I when I knew that she was going to come into the office, I called all my friends from back home. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to meet Jennifer Aniston. And they all said, you know, you have to tell us what happens. And so, you know, she comes into the office and she's there for a job to do, and so was I. So the extent of our meeting was she was like, hi, I'm Jennifer, and I was like, hi, I'm Taylor, and like that was it. Like that was the whole thing. And I thought, I can't call each individual person and be like, she said her name's Jennifer, right? So I wrote a story about it, and it was basically just the build up of this moment and then how small it was. It's like, oh my God, this is gonna happen, you know. And I went through the course of my day, and it was the first thing I'd ever written, and I didn't write it to write something. I wrote it really because I was trying to make something out of nothing to tell my friends. And so the whole joke of the piece was like, it was very small and nothing happened.
But you got to meet Jennifer Aniston.
I did get to meet her.
That's true.
Yeah.
Did she shake your hand?
She did.
Which
hand? I mean, I'm assuming my right. Oh. Yeah. I mean, yeah, right? Hard to say, but I think it was my right. And a lot of people wrote back to me, and they said that it was a good story and that I should be a writer. And so that, like, I mean, I always like to do things that people compliment me on. So I continued to try and write other stories of things that had happened to me. And then eventually that became, I mean, I ran out of interesting things that had happened to me because I'm not that interesting of a person. And so I moved on to writing fiction.
Fantastic. And tell us, who is Daisy Jones?
Daisy Jones is one of the lead singers of Daisy Jones and the Six. That should be obvious. I don't know why I just said that. But she is originally a groupie coming out of L.A. She's beautiful and very glamorous. And from a very young age, she has this sort of charisma that people are very drawn to. But she wants to be an artist. She sees herself as a songwriter, and people don't really take her seriously for that. The men in her life mostly want to sleep with her or use her ideas in order to better themselves. And so she really tries to take charge of her own career and insist on her time in the spotlight. And so she becomes one of the greatest rock singers of the 70s within the context of the book, because she is not real.
And we'll come back to the context of that book and a bit more about that scene in LA as well, which I'm really interested in a moment. Damien, just to turn to you, You Will Be Safe Here is your first novel, and congratulations. It's getting a lot of praise already. And it's inspired by real events, isn't it?
Yeah, it's partly inspired by real events. I wasn't looking to write a novel. I'd been touring with my memoir and running the salon and being very happy doing all that. So I found a newspaper story online about a boy who had been murdered in South Africa. And this boy looked just like a boy that I'd gone to school with. He'd come to my school in Scotland for a year and gone back to South Africa, and I'd never seen him again because it was before social media, until I saw a picture of this boy in the paper and he'd been killed. And of course it wasn't the boy that I'd gone to school with, but it looked just like him. And I became obsessed by the story of what happened to this boy and following the trial online, because South Africa's in the same time zone as the UK, so I could follow it. But very quickly details started to disappear. South Africa is a very violent country. There's a lot of crime there. And even a case as horrific as the murder of Raymond Boys disappeared. And I couldn't stop thinking about this boy whose parents had sent him to a place where they make men out of boys. That's the slogan of the camp, which is run by former soldiers. And I discovered that, you know, not only had he been killed there, two other boys had been killed there. And this was a network of camps across South Africa. And then I started to delve into, you know, camps in South Africa, and discovered that during the Boer War, during the Second Boer War in 1900, Britain invented the concentration camp in South Africa. We made a homeless nation of women and children by burning all these farms, and then we concentrated people into camps, and that's the origin of the expression concentration camp. And to me, there was just a really clear line from the history to the present. And I wanted to expose that and explore it through telling the stories of people on the ground at the time. Tyari Jones said, I think, that, you know, you talk about people and their stories, not stories and their people. So the first part is historical. It's about Sarah and her son Fred, and they're sent to a place called Bloemfontein concentration camp. And there they have to survive, but they also make friends, and good fun things happen to them too, like there's a choral society in a school, because previously these people had lived on their own in the middle of nowhere. Suddenly there's thousands of them in one space, so they make friends. And then there's a contemporary story about a boy called Willem who prefers books to sports and animals to people, and who is sent by his mother and her boyfriend to a place called New Dawn, and he's sent there in order to be straightened out, basically. So it's a story of connected stories, and it ranges over 100 years, but it's actually quite a short book. I realised after spending a year editing it down to nothing, it's quite short. And it's intense. There's a lot in there. But yeah, that's the story. It's really about mothers and sons and survival. You know, what would you do to survive in a place like this?
And was it a case that the story sort of grabbed you to the point where you're like, I've got to write it now?
Well, I just had to know. I ended up going to South Africa and finding this boy's mother and going to the place where he'd been killed, and written a big feature about it for The Guardian this week, actually. you know, I put myself in an incredibly dangerous situation without really realizing what I was doing, because I just had to know. I think when you get a hold of something, I don't know if it's the same for you, Taylor, when you get a hold of something, if you can't stop thinking about it, you know, you can't rest, you know. And initially I thought maybe I would do a bit of journalism or maybe I would do a bit of nonfiction. And it became a novel because I couldn't answer all the questions. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to make stuff up. And if you're making stuff up, it's a novel. And so that's what it became. But it's been 5 years of my life. It's been a really long time.
Yeah.
But I'm really happy in the end that I've managed to give a voice to these people who have, these women and children from 100 years ago, and these boys now, who, by the way, are still being sent to places like New Dawn.
Yeah, this is just unbelievable, isn't it, really? We'll talk a little bit more about, you know, South Africa and your trip there in a mo, but Taylor, back to you and about this fascination with the music scene from mm-hmm. I assume the 1970s and mm-hmm. certainly the West Coast music scene, which is part of the whole Daisy Jones and the Six thing. So we're talking like a Fleetwood Mac style era,
yeah.
and music. That's such an exciting time for music, for we look back now on it and we still listen to those albums. You know, what was it for you that made you think, I'm going to set it there in my hometown and I'm going to set it around this sort of music?
I think I'm always looking to set things in Los Angeles. I like writing about Los Angeles, and I think that we write a certain type of Los Angeles all the time, that is not, in my experience, the one that I know. And so all of my books have taken place there, except for one, which only half takes place there. But so that's first and foremost. So when I'm looking at a story, I'm often thinking, where does it fit in Los Angeles? And if you're going to write a story about music in Los Angeles, there are a couple of times that you have to choose from, and a lot of them do take place on the Sunset Strip, but the one that was the most exciting for me is the 70s, because yeah, it's Fleetwood Mac and it's the Eagles and it's Linda Ronstadt and Jackson Brown, and it just was an exciting time, and it was a romantic time in which I, you know, 70s rock, especially when we're getting into more of the, like, what we would now call like easy listening or like soft rock, women were let in a bit more, and that's something that I'm much more interested in writing about, that where women have a little bit of a claim of the space. And so I thought, well, I'm going to make up a band that's you know, got men and women in it, that really comes into their own in the late 70s and would sound somewhere in between, you know, like Fleetwood Mac maybe on one side and like Springsteen on the other. Mm. Like they're somewhere in between there. And so that was the excitement for me, because you do tap into that nostalgia for that time, right? Like, I'm gonna spend at least a year of my life in this space, so I want it to be one that I'm excited about and one that feels like, oh, that'd be so cool to do that, as opposed to like, and then I'm gonna have to research X and Y. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. it just felt like, oh, who wouldn't want to spend weeks at a time like researching 70s rock? Like, that was very fun.
But how do you decide what research to keep in and what to keep out? Because the thing I became obsessed by the research one.
Yeah.
And I spent months and months and months in libraries obsessing over diaries and pictures and things.
Yeah.
And of course, there was just no room for it in the end. You know, I knew it all. I was like, oh, but you can't shove it all.
But that's important work too, though. You know, like, I do think you have to know a lot more than you can include. Mm. I think that's important. And for me, you know, I'm always focused. I'm always very deadline focused. Mm. So I give myself a firm date of when each thing needs to be done. And that helps me get to a point where, you know, I have to make a decision about what's great versus good enough. Mm. And I do try to err on the side of good enough until I get to the end of the process and I think, okay, now is my opportunity to make it great. But in general, you know, I do about 6 months of research on 6 months. That's not true. 6 weeks. And hearing me say it, it sounded so bold. I do about 6 months of research. No, 6 weeks. 6 weeks. 6 weeks of research, and at the end of that 6 weeks, I think, you know, okay, I gotta, you know, if I'm continuing to research, I'm doing because I don't want to write the book, so I need to like get down and start writing, and I'll research as I go.
But that's an interesting point you make, Damien, where you're saying, you know, you got sort of obsessed about it, you were reading up about it, and yet it is quite a short book.
Mm.
So do you think there's something in that, in that, that you've managed to sort of sub it all down because of doing all that research, that, that you've made it dense and yet it's not a long sort of
I think of it as Jenga. So, right. You know, what can I take away and it will still stand up? And so I spent a whole year Jengifying the book, whereas taking stuff away, taking away whole characters, taking away whole relationships. And it was interesting, actually, if it's really easy to kill somebody in a book, to get rid of them, not kill them on the page, but take them out, they didn't need to be there in the first place. They were already a ghost of a something. So I was surprised by how easy some of that was. I think you just, if it's essential for the story, then it stays. If it's essential for your ego or just because you love it and it's a little factoid that you just like stroking, then you can still stroke it. You just don't need to put it in the book.
It's sometimes hard to tell the difference, though, right? It's like you'll come upon a section and it's like, I love this, but you really have to interrogate why you love it and what you love about it. And
it's just, I love that I know this.
Yeah.
I know this. So, I mean, I had some brilliant first readers, and my editor, Alexa von Hirschberg, is incredible. And so, you know, and she's also South African, which was interesting and helpful. So I think I did take away a lot of stuff. And I also very much wanted to leave space for the reader in this book. I am not, for myself, not a fan of books where every question is answered or answered in a way that means there's no room for interpretation. And I know this is something your characters deal with too, Taylor, with this idea of disputed history, what happened, what really happened. And I think that you know, as the writer, and the characters may think they know, and they may have competing versions of history, but that's all right, you know. And I think actually that's what's interesting. And so I've definitely left space in my book for the reader to make their mind up about certain characters and make their mind up about certain events. I think particularly in South Africa, history is very disputed. It is not a constant. It is constantly being renegotiated, in fact. And I wanted to show that process on the page. So there are a couple of key facts, a couple of key moments which recur through the book, which are reflected and refracted differently. And that's because I didn't want to overwhelm the reader with, you know, too much knowledge. I mean, I could have written 5 books about this, and I keep thinking, oh, should I write a sequel? And actually, I think it's probably unhealthy. I think I just need to
move on.
But there is a part of my brain which is thinking, well, what does happen when they go back to the farm, and, you know, and does Willem get a boyfriend, and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But,
and also, it's all still in there, isn't it? You know, it's all still very fresh for you. and actually, you touched on it, Damien, earlier in your book. You decided, Taylor, to sort of write the book in a script style biography form. So this is a very different way of consuming prose. What was it that made you want to write it like that, like an account?
Yeah, so it's written as an oral history, and typically when oral histories are written, they're written about nonfiction, about things that really happened. But I really like reading them. The premise is basically that you have this cultural moment, whether it's an album or a band or a TV show or a movie, whatever it is. And you know, 20 years later, 40 years later, everyone comes together, the people that were involved in it, to tell you the story of how it came into being. It's a structure that I really love reading. And so I've read a lot of them in my life, and my husband had been reading like a few, like he went through like a period of time where it was like the Saturday Night Live oral history, which is like a 600 page book that they keep adding like every new season of SNL, they like add sections to it. But so there were just like a lot of them around me, and I thought, well, what if you did that but fiction? And I was thinking that at the same time that I had been thinking I really wanted to write about a band. And so they sort of came together, and I thought, okay, here's the book. You write an oral history about a 70s rock band. And it is a different way to tell a story, certainly in fiction. I mean, you open the book and you'll see, you know, it's a chorus of voices who are telling you this story. So Daisy says what she thinks happened, then Billy, and then you're cutting back and forth all the time. Daisy, Billy, Karen, Warren, Eddie, you know, all these people are chiming in, and they don't agree, and they don't remember things accurately. And I think what is really fun about that format is that you can also tell a story about the nature of human memory, that we don't remember things clearly, and what we do remember is always serving us in one way or another, even if it's telling a negative story about us or portraying us in a negative light, it's because we want to see ourselves that way. Mm. We're always telling ourselves every day the story of ourselves. Mm. I was here, I got here, this is how I learned this. And it's kind of a false idea, right? Like, you, even the story of your day, you're picking and choosing the things that turn it into a story. You're not choosing the things that you find irrelevant. You're highlighting things and you're muting things and editorializing your own life all the time.
We're all unreliable narrators.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when you get all of these people together to talk about this band and this album and why it worked and why they broke up, every single person is bringing every moment of their lives to that story.
Yeah.
And that was the best, most fun part about writing in that style. If I the other day someone was like, would you write another oral history? And I was like, if I can get away with it, if people aren't going to call me a one-trick pony, yeah, absolutely.
But
it's really
you?
Fun.
I mean, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's definitely, where I am right now, I take such an effort to, with every book, not do the thing I've done already. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But I look back on the ways in which, in my earlier books, you know, if I told a story in one structure, if I thought that structure worked for the next story that I wanted to tell, I was like, I can't do that. I've already done that. And I look back on it and I'm like, no, I totally could have. Mm. It would have been fine to do it. So I don't know. Like, we'll see. I really loved it. And I mean, it comes with a lot of challenges as well. But they're ones that I think I've learned and I feel really confident about navigating now. So yeah, I would love to do another one.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
We will see.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's time now for the book off. We have here my handy props.
The bell.
And the horn. Taylor, you get to decide whether you'd like to be rung out or honked out after your 3 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay. I think I'd prefer the bell.
You like the bell?
I'm sorry
okay.
that I'm giving
okay,
you the horn.
Okay. I'm sorry that I'm giving you the horn. Align the
and I'm sorry that I'm giving you the horn.
I will take the horn.
But you get to decide if you go first or second.
I'll go second.
Okay.
Oh, see, let's that see. Was the...
Straight sorry, away yeah. straight away as well. So I'm going to put 3 minutes on the clock for you, Taylor. You don't have okay. to use all three.
Okay.
But as soon as we reach the three... That's okay. going to be coming out, all right?
All right.
I'll also make sure you can see it as well.
Oh, good. Okay. That was so the part I was going to ask you. Yeah. Great.
So it's over to you to tell us about The Hate U Give and Why We Should All Read It by okay. Angie Thomas.
All right. So I think the biggest reason why everyone should read The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas is because it is the best example I've ever read of changing people's point of view and telling a very important story without compromising entertainment. I think a lot of times when we tell stories about people that are issue driven, the issue becomes more than the story, mm. and which is fine. I love that work too. But what Angie Thomas has done is written a story in which it's not. Doesn't feel like eating your vegetables. It's a fun story to read with characters that you really care about. And it's the most perfect example I can think of in recent years where by simply telling the truth about what people's lives are like and making the characters people that you care about, you can change minds. I mean, reading is supposed to foster empathy. That's one of the most important things that it can do. When you tell stories about people that are facing a particular issue, like in The Hate U Give, which is a story of a black young girl in the U.S. whose friend is shot by a policeman. This is something that in the U.S. we're dealing with all the time. It's on the news cycle constantly. And there's this question of Black Lives Matter, you know, and what that means. And I think people misinterpreting what it means a lot, because all that it means is that black lives also matter. They matter in addition to white lives and all other lives. It's a really hot button issue. And yet telling one girl's story in a way where you care about this girl, I think will give you empathy for what it's like to be living in communities in which the police are not your savior. The police are your enemy. Mm-hmm. And so I think Angie Thomas has done something really incredible, because she's told one very specific story that is fun to read. It's good. You care about the characters. And yet by the end of it, I think you feel changed in understanding. Either the fiction should do two things, right? It should comfort the uncomfortable or discomfort the comfortable. And this book does both. If you don't deal with this issue, you now understand a little bit of what it's like. And if you do, then you feel seen and you know that someone else is telling this story. So I think it's an incredibly powerful book that reads as if it's fun and easy, which is very difficult to do.
Fantastic.
All right.
Bring you out anyway. Yay. You had 10 seconds to go. 10 seconds to go. But that was wonderful. And such a great book.
Such a
wonderful person, isn't she, Angie? Yeah. We'll talk about it very shortly, but we'll give you your 3 minutes first, Damien. Put that on the clock, because it's over to you to tell us about The Colour Purple.
So The Colour Purple is a novel by Alice Walker that she wrote in the early 1980s, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for it. She was the first black woman to win the Pulitzer Prize. It is one of the most banned books of all time. It has regularly, court cases are brought against it, schools, particularly in America, saying it shouldn't be taught. And why shouldn't it be taught? Well, I was taught it when I was 14 in my school in Scotland, and it changed my view of the world, because here was a story of two sisters in Georgia in the 1920s and 30s. And it's written as a series of letters by these sisters, Celie and Nettie. And it depicts a life of beauty and brutality, of struggle and survival, where these two sisters have this incredibly close bond. They're torn apart by men who marry them off as and when they see fit, who rape them, who beat them, who try as hard as they can to extinguish every shred of their personality, and who fail. And it's one of the most triumphant books, one of the most encouraging books for me. At that time, I was having a really hard time in my own life. Home was really dark and violent, and I was facing a lot of the same issues that Celie and Nettie were facing. And in fact, my best friend, who was also gay, who's in Maggie and Me, he's called Mark in there, he and I called each other Celie and Nettie, and we would write notes to each other in the voices of the characters. So it's a story of how to find friends, and how humans can crush one another but also help one another. There's a brilliant character in there called Shug Avery. Lesbianism is one of the reasons that the book is often banned.
Shug Avery.
She's so hot. She's
amazing.
I'm getting the horn again. Yeah. Shug Avery is this jazz singer who comes into town with all her feathers and her spangles and her voice, her sexy voice. And Celie's husband is into Shug, and Celie is into Shug as well. And we have this bizarre love triangle. I mean, the most unlikely of love triangles. But it's wonderful, and it's beautiful, and it's humane. I would also encourage people, if they haven't read the book, which is written as a series of letters, to watch the film. The Steven Spielberg film is an unusually good adaptation, and was pioneering at the time, because so few films have been made with an all-black cast that they didn't know how to light black skin. So there are lots of pioneering film techniques. It's also a musical. Which I have yet to see, but which I know a lot of people really love. So I would really recommend people for reading it, because it's an insight into a world that you haven't seen, but feelings that you may have felt, of feeling oppressed, of having to stand up for yourself. And you see these women do it in the least likely circumstances, and they do triumph, and we share in that.
Oh, you can't give him the horn then. Oh, God.
I went over. I was 4 seconds over. Oh,
I was even. I was trying. I was like, he's gonna break in a moment. He's gonna break. I'm gonna do.
I was almost in tears. Come on.
I know. Oh wow. I mean, what do you do in a situation like this?
You can because choose them both. I think you should choose them both.
I feel like there's. I'm getting softer in my old age, but more and more, you know, I come to this point and I'm like, I think they both need to just win, don't they? Like, also,
would you have had Angie without Alice? I think there.
Oh my God!
You know,
it'll be very interesting to see how the Hate U Give ages and the way that we see it over time.
The Come Up, which is Angie's second novel, which was published early this year, is just as good. Right? Mm-hmm. It is so.
She's
brilliant
very
as well.
Very talented,
and she set that in the same fictional town, but very totally different characters. Mm-hmm. But I just loved both of your pitches, and I loved the sort of personal elements from each of you about those books. I also loved at the very beginning when we talked about them, you each were like, "No way! Oh my God!"
It's funny. We both came to it, I think, for the similar. When you ask a question of what should everyone read, you start to like think and view your reading habits differently.
It's a very different question to what's your favorite book, which
is
impossible to answer, but also I would never ask that of someone. The whole point is it's about this sharing. It's about people listening in and thinking, I've got to go and read that now I've heard that. And I think after hearing both of your pitches, that's going to happen. I love them both. Let's call it a draw for today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you both here. Thank you for not going back to LA so soon. Thank you for getting up early and coming up from Brighton.
My pleasure.
You Will Be Safe Here by Damien Byers, published by Bloomsbury, and Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid is published by Hutchinson. Both absolutely fabulous books, both out now, and you should get them. Enjoy being back with your daughter. Enjoy the LA sun.
Thank you.
And I'll be over to visit you soon.
Great.
And Damien, good luck with the rest of your year, because it looks like
you pretty much
booked it up. By the way, I should have asked. I meant to ask this earlier. How's the salon doing? What can we expect?
We have a salon coming up in June, all about outsider voices at the Theatre Royal in Brighton, with Tracy Thorne and Dustin Lance Black. So two really different voices, but two outsiders, and it's going to be a great night. So people
absolutely
can come on down.
When's that in June?
June the 23rd. So you can check it out on literarysalon.co.uk.
And Tracy joined us for Book Off a couple of episodes ago, and she's got so much to talk
about. What was her book?
About.
What did she choose?
That's a great question. it was Donna Tartt's
Secret History.
Secret History.
Oh, that's a good one. That's
it's a pretty good one.
That's a solid, like, who
that's
could disagree?
We all went, yeah.
Great book. I think at this point everyone has read it, right?
I think so. But she was rereading it, which was why it was interesting.
I wonder if I should reread it.
Because I don't reread many books.
I don't either.
I reread it a couple of years ago, and it is as good.
Yeah? Okay.
Maybe that's the one.
Yeah, maybe I should reread it.
Right, so Tracy, with you in June.
And Dustin.
And Dustin, of course, fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure. Hope to see you again soon.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
Thank you.